What's the deal with this?
Deal? What are you saying?
Deal.
Deal?
I don't see what the big deal is, you know? It's not that great.
Good deal. You won't regret it.
What's the deal, son? What do you have going?
All right, look, here's the deal.
What do you say we're making some deal?
Global real estate tech investments have been on a tear over the past several years. However, despite the surge in total venture deals, the venture capital market in real estate tech has begun to tighten. Over the past 12 months, the industry was marked by volatility and uncertainty for both investors and technology companies alike. Investors deployed $9.6 billion in 2018, a 23% decrease in total volume of dollars since 2017, despite a near 47% gain in total deal volume during the same period. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Ellie Feingold, venture advisor and entrepreneur in residence at Metaprop NYC. The Metaprop NYC Real Estate Technology Accelerator is the world's leading growth program for early stage companies. The program boasts over 80 mentors, world-renowned corporate partners, and focuses exclusively on real estate technology. This episode is brought to you by InCheck by Site Comply. InCheck is a building operations platform used by thousands of property management teams to get visibility, accountability, and consistency and grow their portfolios and profits. Find out more, go to incheckapp.com. That's INCHECKAPP.com. I'm your host, Ryan Cox, managing partner at Founders Grove Capital, a multifamily value-add investment firm. Real Estate Innovators is a podcast that explores innovation in commercial real estate. We celebrate the companies and innovators who are changing the business of commercial real estate and are inspiring the future of how we work, live, and play. Ellie Feingold has a long history in commercial real estate, and he is extremely active in the technology space. I asked Ellie to talk about his background in real estate and technology.
I'm originally from Seattle, and I went to college and studied music, ethnomusicology. I actually created my own degree at Harvard, mostly because I wanted to listen to music instead of take courses. I wrote a book about Israeli popular music, and then quickly discovered that there was not really much of a market for that particular skill set, as much as I wish there had been. So while I was still in college, I started my first web development company in 1994. And at that point, literally my first customers, I would go and draw little pictures of boxes with lines between them to try to explain to them what the internet was, what the web was going to be. I sold that company and started another company, which is sort of how my real estate career began. It was a company called Qubits.com, and it was an online VC marketplace that we founded in 1998. And it was a demand-driven model, so it was really focused on sort of smaller tenants, serving sort of the same market area that the Liquid Spaces of the world had been sort of targeting and the Pivot Desks were targeting, et cetera. And that company, we were growing, we raised some money, things were going great, and we were preparing for our next round. We had our term sheet signed. And then the NASDAQ crashed, and basically all of the capital spigots turned off, and we quickly realized that we were not going to be able to wait for the capital markets to freeze. So we sold the company to Insignia Financial Group, which some of you may remember was, at the time, was one of the largest real estate services firms in the world. It was on scale with Trammell Crowe and CBRE and JLL and Cushman. And I became the chief innovation officer of Insignia. And that meant that I had to worked on several things there. First of all, I worked on a portfolio of companies that they had invested, technology companies that invested, called the Edifice Rex companies, many of which bear remarkable similarities to some of the companies that are coming out now, but were just a little too early. It was pre-high-speed internet and pre-mobile. And while on the one hand, I'd like to say we're way ahead of our time. On the other hand, if you're too early, sometimes you're just wrong. And so I worked on helping some of those companies wind up, wind down, get sold, etc. And then we sold Insignia to CBRE, and I went off with Insignia's chairman, Andrew Farkas, to help found Island Capital Group, which is now the owner of C3 Capital Partners and NAI and a bunch of other things. And my primary job there was as founding president of Island Global Yachting, IGY Marinas. And that was my first real estate role. And so we built a company that had a couple billion and a half dollars of assets under management globally. We had about 1,000 employees, and it was a vertically integrated luxury mega yacht marina company. And so we built everything from, we built the marinas on the Palm Island in Dubai. We acquired stuff all over the Caribbean and in Mexico. We operated them. We bought an engineering firm. And I also got into development then, and did my first development, which was, it was a relatively simple first development. It was a mixed use $250 million project, including the world's most sophisticated mega yacht marina, built on landfill in the middle of the crossroads of an island in the Caribbean. So that was a relatively simple project to work on, but it did give me exposure to almost every phase of real estate development, and then eventually management operations through 6 or 7 intense years, and also helped me understand how global the real estate business is from a capital perspective and how often local it is from a utilization perspective. After doing that, and flying all over the world all the time and basically living a life of jet lag, I decided I met a woman and decided I'd had enough and I wanted to get married. It's the best decision I've ever made in my life. So I left that job, and a couple years later, I joined CBRE, where I was their first global head of innovation. So I've actually led global innovation projects at two of the world's largest publicly traded real estate companies, which either makes me a fool for going back to the well twice or just a glutton for punishment. And at CBRE, I focused on global innovation across all the business lines and all of the geographies, which was an extraordinary platform from which to operate. CB is, as you know, one of the great real estate companies in the world. They have operations everywhere and operate in almost every segment. And so that was a spectacular experience. We did a number of things. We talked about the company's strategy for how it was going to approach technology globally going forward. We worked with the startup community. So I worked with many of the sort of what I call sort of real prop tech 2.0, which was sort of that first wave of the VTSs and the Hightowers and the Fords, the Compstacks. And then we also had an internal function called CBRE Labs, which was essentially a startup incubator inside of CBRE, where we had a team that ran pilots and built prototypes and actually developed some of the foundational concepts for some of the products that you're seeing CBRE roll out now. So our job was always to be, it was in my job description, to be 2 to 3 years ahead of the business and thinking about what was just over the horizon. And that was just an extraordinary opportunity with an extraordinary company. That said, after a while, I decided that I wanted to get back into being an entrepreneur, and so I took some time off. And these days, I've now got a bunch of oars in the water. I'm working as a venture advisor to Metaprop out of New York City. Metaprop, as you know, is an accelerator and a community builder that's now transforming increasingly into an early stage venture capital fund. They recently raised a $40 million fund. And so I assist their portfolio companies and the team at Metaprop on both investment decisions and operational strategy. I work with a bunch of companies as an advisor, sort of outside of that Metaprop function, including some of your guests, City Builder, Brian Copley, Brian Turner at Refinery. I work with a residential company called Local Life that just launched its product in Dallas, a retail technology company called HeroFi, a property management company called Estate, a parking company called Park Hub, and a residential-focused financial services product called Stake, amongst a couple others. I may be forgetting. So, but I work with a bunch of companies that sort of span the spectrum of product types in real estate to try to keep an eye on what's going on and have a good flow of information about the transformations that are happening in virtually every sector of real estate you can imagine right now. And then finally, I'm working on a couple of projects of my own, all of which are focused around a sort of central thesis that real estate is fundamentally changing right now and that we're at a fascinating inflection point in the history of real estate.
With a heavy background in real estate and as a technology advisor, I asked Ellie, what are the key features of a technology startup or business models that he is finding interesting or exciting?
I think the most fundamental thing that's happening in real estate is a true transformation in the way that people consume, think about, value, utilize, operate real estate. And that's driven by a combination of radical mobility, which is we now live in a hyper mobile information age. As we all know, we can, you know, it's been said to death, we can now work, do almost anything from almost anywhere. By the sharing economy, and I will say that's writ large, that includes everything from transportation as a service to delivery, to the co-working spaces that are increasingly dominating our landscape. And I think that's soon to be hypercharged, a lot of that by revolutions in transportation, particularly autonomous transportation, which I think is going to have a more profound impact than many of us realize. Like many things, it may have a shorter, a lesser impact in the short term, but a bigger impact in the long term than we think about. It may take longer to get there, but it will have a bigger change. And around all of that, you have an increasing amount of data that is being thrown off by all of those transactions, whether that's understanding how tenants are moving or actual occupants are moving through your buildings, how cars are moving through the streets, what utilities are being used in what times and in what ways. And all of that creates an opportunity to optimize. So, you know, to me, this is one of the most exciting possible times to be not only in real estate technology, but in real estate itself, because what has for many of us for most of our lifetimes felt like a fairly static and fixed environment has now become a suddenly dynamic and transformative one.
It's really left up to the imagination about how autonomous vehicles are going to reshape and reconstruct our lives. I asked Ellie to expand on his thoughts about autonomous vehicles.
I think when people think of autonomous vehicles, they tend to think of a car that's being driven by itself. And that's because our conception of what transportation is has been so dominated by the automobile. So while I think that there may be cars that drive themselves, autonomy is going to have a much broader array of impacts as you have highly specialized vehicles for very specialized tasks that are going to be able to do certain things. So, you know, just like we're seeing with the revolution in micro-mobility and the shared bikes, we're going to see that revolution sort of enhanced with autonomy in delivery of goods and services. So for instance, you may have an autonomous vehicles that are delivering food or your Amazon package right to your doorstep that don't need to have the kind of level 5 full scale or have an accident autonomy that you need with a human, because they'll be traveling at slower speeds and carrying goods instead of people. And they don't need to be engineered for the most extreme use case. Many of us drive SUVs, which is great if you need to drive 8 people up a mountain in the middle of a snowstorm. That's the car for you. But 9 times out of 10, when you need to go 10 blocks as one person to go and pick up a few things at the grocery store, it's really not an optimal vehicle. And so I think that while we think about autonomous cars often, what we really should be thinking about is this proliferation of very, very specialized mobile solutions that will deliver both goods and people to right in time to the places they need to be. And so I think it's going to be an extraordinary world. It's going to look a lot like, I always think that it may look like Star Wars, where you have all these different robots that each do specialized things, and that's more what the future is going to look like for us, which I never thought I'd be saying that the future looks like Star Wars, but here we are.
Back to the second part of the question, I asked Ellie how mobility, autonomy, and specialization reshapes our world and the landscape of commercial real estate. How does that filter impact the ideas of today and who he chooses to work with?
Well, it's hard because there's an extraordinary number of entrepreneurs. We are in the middle of, I've been in the real estate tech world for almost 20 years, which is terrifying even to say. And what we have right now is an absolute proliferation of incredible new ideas coming into the business. For the first time in the entire history of real estate tech that I've been involved in, there's an enormous amount of capital that has been not just sort of guided towards, but is actually allocated towards these real estate tech startups. So you now have venture funds that are with a purely real estate thesis. And then we have all of these people coming from outside of the industry who are really doing some of them doing very creative things to re-engineer it. So I look for, when I'm thinking about who I work for, of course, and this is true, which is, of course, it always starts with the people. You look for founders that are committed, that have a vision, that know what they don't know, and are prepared to build out teams to help them get that knowledge. Because oftentimes where you have this overlap of tech, real estate, and then building a business, those are actually all three different skill sets. And so finding people who are able to have both the intellectual capacity and the temperamental capability to accommodate all of those things and build a team around that. And that's just, I think, a fundamental part of building a good startup. Beyond that, I'm looking for companies that are really thinking about a few years down the road. So while there are some very interesting companies that are focused on re-engineering current processes, the ones that I find most exciting are the ones that are really thinking about, hey, what's the world going to look like in 5 years? And how are we going to accommodate that? What are the new ways that people are going to use real estate? What are the new ways that people are going to shop? What are the new kinds of data that are going to be produced? And how can I get ahead of that curve? So I think that there's just an enormous array of interesting companies right now. And the honest truth is, right now it's hard to figure out who to talk to and who to spend time with and who to invest in, because there's so many great ideas. But each of the verticals and functions of real estate are being transformed. And so I think there's opportunity in each of those.
I asked Ellie about the impact of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and blockchain on commercial real estate.
First of all, I'm going to quibble over your categories, because artificial intelligence and machine learning are so closely related that I'm not sure where one ends and the other begins. I think what we have is increasingly the ability to access enormous sets of data that are incredibly dynamic in real time, and process them to create real-time insights and connect those to results. That was a long set of buzzwords, so let me go back and, assuming that I remember all of them, try to get through them. So first of all, we have these huge pools of data that are being created. Every day we have, every interaction that we have is now digitized, and that means that it's being dumped into a data pool. We have the cloud and cloud services, which allow people to spin up and access these pools of data with increasing simplicity. So what used to be very difficult to combine sets of data has now become increasingly easy. That we now have programs that can run analytics and actually learn in real time from what they're doing. And that's partly because you have a feedback mechanism, because as you get those insights, you can actually translate that into change on the ground through automation, because you have machines talking to machines, learning from machines, as scary as that sounds. And that's really a revolution. It's a revolution to be able to have real-time feedback for real estate decisions. And while I think we're still at the beginning, it's going to be a big deal. And the reason I say that we're still at the beginning is less of a technological issue than it is the fact that we have yet to have significant longitudinal data sets for a lot of these very, very highly parsed analytics. So we now have data sets going back for a few years, but as we get longer and longer sample sizes of bigger and bigger data sets, those insights are going to become ever more actionable, insightful, and potentially revolutionary.
I asked Ellie about technology's growth in commercial real estate and the impact to asset managers and brokerage.
I spent a lot of time thinking about brokerage, both as you know, I worked at several of the largest brokerages in the world thinking about innovation. What's happening, I think, everybody thought that potentially data was going to disrupt brokerage, which it never really did. CoStar and Xceligent and the various data tools, they became enabling tools that allowed brokers to work better, smarter, and faster. But they never took away the essential value proposition of the brokerage. I think what's happening, and we'll see, is that the way that people are using real estate is changing because of technology, because of these exogenous technology impacts, right? The ability to move around. And that is actually disrupting brokerage in a way that is radically different than anyone could have seen 5 or 10 years ago. And that doesn't mean that there's no role for the broker, because driving from insight to action on transactions is something where you're going to need experts and you're going to need advice. The areas, I always like to say that the areas that are most ripe for disruption are where there are frequent transactions of relatively small size and relative simplicity to the customer. So the things that you do that are relatively easy to understand or are relatively low risk. Big real estate decisions simply aren't like that. They're relatively infrequent, they're relatively complicated, and they're generally big financial decisions. And so I think there will always be a role for the broker in that kind of decision making. But those brokers who are focused more on providing insights, analysis, and really highly specialized real estate intelligence over those who are simply about matching buyers and sellers are going to be the winners in the long term. When we talk about development, I actually think this is going to go off on a slightly different tangent, but I think what's happening with modular construction is going to be absolutely fascinating in the future. And there's an enormous amount of capital being thrown into that space, including the $800 million SoftBank investment in Terra and a ton of others. But over time, I think as these technologies are going to be able to allow developments to be built faster, quicker, and potentially be recyclable. And if you think about that last part, the fact that you can potentially recycle, that is, you can take apart the pieces of the building and reassemble it somewhere else or reassemble it in a different configuration, that is a potentially yet another radical shift in the underpinnings of what we have traditionally considered as the hard, fast, and inevitable truth of real estate development, which is that once you build it, put a building up, it's going to have a life cycle of 60 to 100 years. That may not be true in the future. People may look at buildings and say, hey, this is an asset that we're going to put up for 5 or 10 years and we're going to take it down and move up somewhere else or in a different configuration using the same materials. So I just think that that's going to be that's a very exciting place. And while we have always thought about prefabricated construction in terms of, be careful, wide load, homes being driven down the freeway, the fact that they are now being built in panelized components that can be used on the intermodal transportation system that can be containerized and everything like that essentially allows them to go into the big transportation network and see radically decreased transportation costs and therefore radically increased efficiency for factory produced building materials.
I've been really curious about the modular space, but the idea of being able to reconfigure, take down, reuse buildings, and increase efficiency is a really expansive thought. I asked Ellie to expand on it.
The idea that you can take buildings apart and reuse them is, I think, going to be not only provide incredible efficiency, but it's going to become an increasingly environmental necessity, right? Buildings consume an enormous amount of resources. And if you stop and think about it, does it make any sense that when you demolish a building, you basically wind up with a bunch of scrap? No, not if you can build it in a modular way and take it, like Legos and put it back together. Now, I think we're a long way from there. I want to be very clear that this is not something that's going to happen in, the next couple of years, because we have a lot of adjustments to do. There's a lot of technology that has to be put in place. There's a lot of scale that has to be built. There's a lot of new job skills that are going to have to be learned. But over time, I think that that's coming our way.
With all of the capital and technology that is flowing into commercial real estate and the rise of WeWork, I asked Ellie how he sees the power structure of commercial real estate evolving in the next 5 to 10 years.
I think that what we're really seeing, when you come down to it, is power shifting towards the individual worker. And WeWork is a manifestation of that. The power used to lie largely with the corporation, where you had to come into your office and you had to be there. Therefore, they drove the real estate decisions. Therefore, they were the primary customer of investors. But that's changing. Now it's the individual worker who makes the decision. Am I going to go into the office today? If so, what benefits am I going to get from it? That then cycles back to the corporate occupiers, and I'm talking mostly about office and industrial, I suppose. Then that cycles back to the corporate occupiers who say, hey, we need to create a product that's going to make people want to come in to get a certain set of outcomes that will benefit us. And we want to optimize that because they don't need to do everything in the office. And that's how you get, what WeWork is doing. Convene is doing this in ways that are very interesting, Industrious, Knotel. And that's the shift that we're seeing. And that's driving back to the landlord. So their biggest customer is no longer the corporation. Their biggest customer is really now the individual tenant and the individual occupant. And the individual occupant is driving decision-making in a way that I don't think we've ever seen before.
I asked Ellie which verticals of the real estate space does he expect the model to shift from corporate power back down to the individual decision-maker?
I think you could make an argument, and we're just beginning to see this, and I'm a little hesitant about this, I'll be honest, because I'm not quite sure how this is going to play out in the long term. But I think that one of the things you're going to see is in multifamily, we're now starting to see sort of co-living and shorter-term rentals and all of these various both physical and financial products that are engineered to allow a much more mobile lifestyle, not only day-to-day, but also month-to-month and year-to-year. And so I think you're going to see it in the multifamily space as well. We're beginning to see the transformation of sort of co-living models Now, co-living models, I'm a little hesitant to say how much of that is simply a part of the fact that we're in an extremely tight economy with an extremely tight housing market, but it's also simply a more efficient way to live, especially in an increasingly on-demand economy. People have less stuff. They do more services than they used to. They use less raw products. And I think that that's starting to be reflected in the way that some of these new co-living facilities are being built.
There continues to be an increase of options at the corporate level for the individual. And that optionality is going to bleed over into individuals' decisions about where to work, where to live, and for how long. I can work in any WeWork in any major city, but I also might choose to live in Los Angeles for 3 months out of the year, and in Austin for 8 months out of the year, and maybe London for a month. I asked Ellie his thoughts about that increased optionality.
Well, I know which 3 months out of the year I'd live in Los Angeles if I were living in Austin for 8 months of the year. That would be the summer. But I think that's correct. I think that's correct. And I think that when you think about that increased mobility, that ability to move not just from office to office, but from neighborhood to neighborhood and city to city, you have to really think about how deep the technology changes have been that have enabled that to happen. Because we simply have less stuff than we used to. The thing I always think about is all the stuff I used to keep in my car. Right? I used to have papers, and I used to have briefcases, and I used to have all this stuff, and I had CDs, and all of that stuff is gone. When I had a car, it was empty. I've gone carless as an experiment on myself. But part of the reason I can go carless is because all I have to haul around now is my phone and my laptop, iPad, and that's about it. And so I think that increased mobility is really going to sort of spread out in ever widening circles in our lifestyles. One of the things that I think is not discussed enough is the human impacts of this change. So we now have the ability to sort of sit in front of our computer and interact with a whole world. We can order any sort of food or service or delivery into our homes. So all of the things that used to force us to go out and have social interactions are now sort of optional. And so I think that's part of what's driving some of this increasing trend towards mixed use in dense neighborhoods, is because people are choosing what their social environments will be because they're no longer required to have these social interactions on a daily basis. And so that makes these mixed use and denser neighborhoods increasingly important, because otherwise you can just get very, very isolated, and humans are social creatures. And so I think that the psychological and behavioral and social impacts of what's happening are going to be just as important as the technology impacts.
As many listeners to the podcast are focused on discovery and learning about new technology, I asked Ellie which technology we should be paying attention to.
There's three big areas that I'm really interested in. The first is places where data is going to be able to drive decision-making in new ways. And that can be both big decisions and little decisions. So everything from the strategy around which capital is deployed in a given country or city or urban area, to the ways in which desks are arranged on an office floor. And all of those decisions are becoming increasingly data-driven, and those who are able to utilize the new tools the best are going to be the winners. The second area is where people are delivering full-stack solutions of services that actually serve the customer. So I would include the WeWorks of the world, some of the co-working, some of the new hospitality services that are being introduced into both multifamily and office properties. Those full-stack solutions that allow people to access an experience on demand, I think, are going to be really interesting. And while those sound like traditional industries, they're actually being revolutionized by technology, because the frictional cost of delivering them is going down so rapidly. And then the third area that I think is really interesting, as I said, is construction, which I think is an area where we need to keep our eyes on sort of for the next investment cycle. But over time is going to have an increasingly profound effect on the way real estate is valued, utilized, and eventually invested in.
In terms of data-driven decision-making, I asked Ellie, who's off to a hot start with an exciting idea?
There's a number of companies out there. I happen to work with one, City Builder, based out of Seattle, with Brian Copley, who's on your show, where they're doing some fascinating stuff using large data sets to define inefficiencies in development markets. The way that they're doing it is very interesting. And one of the things that I think is fascinating is Brian and his team are focused on raising their own funds to create an investment platform and investment vehicle, so that they're not simply a tool provider, but they're becoming an actual sort of principal. I think Skyline is also focusing in many of the same directions. Cherry, I realize I'm just giving a list of your previous guests here, but that's simply because you've curated them well. But Cherry is a fascinating tool that really provides people with a lot of insights. I think one of the things that's going to be interesting is as people build these tools, whether they choose to keep them in-house and develop investment vehicles around them, or farm them out, or essentially sell them as a software product or a data product to investors who are out there. And I think the future is not yet written. It's possible that the biggest real estate investor of the future may be the small technology and artificial intelligence companies of today.
Okay, let's take topic number two, full stack solutions. There's been a lot that's been written about WeWork. They've taken massive investments. They continue to grow. I asked Ellie to comment on WeWork and who else sits in the full stack solution. It's got him excited.
WeWork is an interesting case. I mean, obviously, it's one of the great real estate companies of our time. And what they have done in terms of redefining what it means to have a workplace is extraordinary, full stop. That said, WeWork, the company, as a vehicle, I have somewhat more concerns about because they have a product that is both delivering an end-to-end solution for customers, and then is also a financial arbitrage product that they are doing with landlords. And I think I will ask the same question that everybody else asks, which is what happens in a down cycle as they have locked in financial commitments and then have to meet a decreased demand for their product. So in that space, I find the ones, the new companies that are really interesting are the ones who are creating hybrid models around that. So the Knotels, and then I think Convene, which is just a fantastic company. What they're doing is really creating that experience in a way that minimizes financial risk to the sort of risk and disruption to the existing financial structure. Owners will still be owners. And I do think that that kind of business model is going to become under less cyclical stress than the model that WeWork has. So I want to give 100% kudos and props to WeWork for their product. At the same time, I think that it remains in question whether or not the financial structure that they built behind it is going to be able to be supported through down cycles.
The economy has exploded over the last decade on the back of one of the longest bull runs on record. I asked Ellie, which companies in technology make it through a downturn?
Not only has there been a lot of prosperity, but there's been a massive change in the workplace, as we've talked about. And what's yet to be proven is the longevity of it. Now, that can range from, there's all sorts of factors that could impact that. First of all, I've been hearing, you know, people are starting to talk about WeWork fatigue and co-working fatigue and wanting to increasingly have more private space and less open work plan environments. You're also seeing stress on the existing infrastructure, some of which is going to be fairly difficult to fix. So there's WeWork has a large asset here in downtown Dallas, for instance, where the WeWork bank of elevators is just unbelievably slow because they've essentially overloaded the occupancy far beyond what anybody ever anticipated when the building was built 30 years ago. And figuring out how to replace that kind of infrastructure is going to be pretty difficult. And so I think that the longevity of this change has to be determined. And the pendulum may swing back a little bit. And I think that's already beginning to happen in some cases, both because of people's desire to have a slightly different experience and growing up and growing older, and also because it is stressing the existing infrastructure in a wide variety of ways. You know, another area where we've seen this happen is in parking, right? So we have everybody is, you know, on the one hand talking about the imminent death of parking. On the other hand, parking is being utilized more heavily than ever because you have more people working within existing spaces. Yet again, another fascinating infrastructure stressor that may also over time have some significant changes in behavior that may render that infrastructure obsolete. And so that's why I work with a parking company, ParkHub, because I'm fascinated by the way in which people are going to reutilize the parking asset over time and how that change is going to manifest itself. Because it's not going to happen all at once. It's not like we're going to wake up one day and people are going to, all of a sudden everybody's going to have an autonomous car and we won't need parking lots. This is going to happen over time. And figuring out what happens in that intervening period, I think, is one of the great questions of our time.
In Ellie's work with ParkHub and helping to create better parking experiences, I asked Ellie how he sees the role of the parking lot evolving in the coming years.
Well, so I think you have several trends that are intersecting and some of them that are yet to come. So at the point of intersection right now, we have co-working, densification, urbanization, all actually putting stress on the existing parking systems. So people are having a hard time finding parking spaces right now because there's simply more people going in and out of buildings than there were before. On the other hand, we have the long-term fact that people are going to be increasingly taking transportation, using transportation as a service. They're moving their cars in and out less. They may be getting dropped off, and it may over time become more efficient to use. When the cost of transportation as a service drops to below a certain point, it will be more efficient to repurpose that parking space into another real estate usage than it will be for parking. That is, it will be easier for your employer to pay for your Uber than it will be easier and cheaper for them to pay for your Uber than it will be for them to pay for your parking space. And we're not at that inflection point yet. We're quite a ways away, but it is coming at some point in the future. Managing that transition and figuring out how to repurpose existing parking infrastructures is going to be an incredible source of value, because all of a sudden, a very significant percentage of the US asset base is going to become both obsolete and able to be reused. And there's going to be a lot of creative uses for that. One of the things that I think is, and I'm not alone in this, sort of an original thought, but the intra-urban, within the city, logistics centers are going to increasingly move into what used to be the parking lots. And that's where services and back of house and all sorts of other stuff is going to be based. And that's going to actually accelerate the trend of parking. So it's going to cannibalize itself as it gets reused and turns into infrastructure for the on-demand economy.
Two more questions for Ellie. First, I asked Ellie what problem is not being attacked with a sense of urgency that should be.
Clearly, the affordability and housing crisis that many of our major cities are experiencing is an area that there is a huge amount of work to be done in which there is literal urgency because people's lives are at stake. In many of our denser cities now, there's an increasing population of working homeless who simply cannot afford who are employable or employed, but simply cannot afford to live in or near the cities where they're working. And I think that that's a real problem. So one of the reasons that I'm very excited about City Builder is because they're focused on helping solve that by creating more efficient multifamily in-city infill development. Again, I think the modular construction is going to be a key for that, as is the co-living thing. So all of these pieces are attacking it from different angles, which is really fascinating when you stop and think about it. Here you have this giant problem that's really sort of just emerging into people's view screens. And you have different ways of attacking it. So one is the construction side of it. One is identifying the opportunities side of it. And the third is, how is it used in a way that becomes increasingly efficient? For instance, co-living is just living in a dorm, right? Now, hopefully you mitigate that with significant increases in service and introduction of technology, all of these other things that will make that experience much better. But it's also creating significant efficiency in the housing market. So I think that's where I would point. That's how I would answer that question, is the affordability and housing crisis. I think it's being attacked. I'm not sure it's being attacked with the urgency that's required. And the human cost of that one is actually fairly high.
And finally, I asked Ellie what success looks like for him over the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, fortunately, through Metaprop and my advisory positions, I get to see a lot of companies. For my personal objective over the next year is to really do two things. I would like to continue to find new companies to work with great innovators across I think the tenant experience spaces and the modular construction space, that's my personal goals. I would like to get into working with both of those. And then I'd also like to see some of the companies that I'm working with, and actually some of the companies in the industry, sort of take the next step. I think you have a lot of companies that have incubated business models in sort of our coastal cities. And I would really like to see some of those, those ideas that are, born and bred in New York coming to the Southwest cities, coming to Texas, amongst other places. And I'd like to see the ideas that are born and bred here in the middle, in the giant middle where, a huge number of people live, start to get more attention from the outside world. So one of the things that I think is very important is creating better networks of venture capital into some of the ideas that are emerging from the Austins, from the Texas, from the Houstons, from the Dallas, from Atlanta, from Phoenix, creating a better support system for the entrepreneurs from the middle of the country so that not everybody who wants to start a company has to go to Boston or San Francisco. That's, I think, a very important thing because most of our country doesn't live in New York and San Francisco, and the solutions to all of our problems do not lie there. Some of those solutions are going to be found in some of the new and exciting markets in the center of our country.
Great to connect with real estate and technology entrepreneur Ellie Feingold today. Ellie is an experienced entrepreneur, corporate strategist, and senior executive at the intersection of real estate and technology. Advisor to both startups, growth companies, venture capital, and private equity firms. He's the former head of global innovation at CBRE, founding president of Island Global Yachting, and founding partner at Island Capital Group. And that concludes our show. I'm excited to follow Ellie in his pursuit to challenge existing business models through commercial real estate technology advisory. Find out more about Ellie in the show notes. Please subscribe to The Real Estate Innovators and write a review wherever you subscribe to podcasts, which helps us grow our audience. Find out more about The Real Estate Innovators at therealestateinnovators.com. Until next time, innovators,